We now shift to the 20th century. Our next speaker is Stephen Collins, also a former colleague of mine from Pikes Peak Community College. Stephen holds a BS degree in engineering physics from the Colorado School of Mines, an MA in communication studies from Colorado State University, and a PhD from Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. Did you ever see Governor Evans? No. Where he studied the history of rhetorical theory and of American public address. He is a professor at Pikes Peak Community College in Colorado Springs, where he teaches learning communities which combine public speaking and other communication courses with United States history. He most recently published Helen Hunt Jackson and the Rhetoric of Humanization, Creating Rhetorical Space Between Traditional Feminine and Masculine Spheres in the 19th Century, in PPLD's Extraordinary Women of the Rocky Mountain West. His other recent presentation at the library's annual history symposium, From Cherry Creek to Sand Creek, The Pioneers Look Back, Colonel John M. Chivington's speech at the quadricentennial celebration of the pioneers' discovery of gold, to be published in the PPLD's Rush to the Rockies, the 1859 Pikes Peak or Bust Gold Rush. That one is forthcoming. Stephen.
Thank you. I'll tell you right off the bat, I do not have a title slide. There's partially a reason for that. The last time I did one on the gold rush, I took the L out of gold and got God. Decided it was probably safer that I didn't. The title of my presentation, if you have the pamphlet in front of you, is The Labeling of Lawfulness and Lawlessness in the Labor Disputes at Ludlow, the Rhetorical Framing of Identity Before, During, and After the Massacre. I am not a traditional historian. I am more of a historian of rhetoric or a rhetorical historian. I study the role of rhetoric, speeches, addresses, forms of symbolic representation for how they are conducted and what impact they have and how they work. And so I get very interested in speeches and rhetorical dilemmas faced by people in history. And so as I talk today about Ludlow, do not ask me questions about the detail of Ludlow. You can ask me questions about the detail of the rhetoric. As I started to do this, I imagined I was going to be looking at several different perspectives from the point of view of Governor Ammons, of General Chase, and also the miners, and including a colorful figure like Mother Jones. The more I started to look at how identity is framed and how people saw themselves, I got more and more interested in the miners. And in particular, when I tried to frame their sense of identity, how they saw themselves, I kept coming back to Mother Jones, because Mother Jones kept being called to all of these labor disputes across the country and was a powerful influence in driving the labor movement. And it was how she defined them that I found them sort of their identity framed. And what was most interesting about that is that it very much depended on how Mother Jones framed her own sense of identity. And so I got very interested in looking at a few of the speeches that Mother Jones had, that we have from that time period during the strike from 1913 to 1914. And so I'm going to talk primarily about Mother Jones today. Kathy Sturdivant spoke about silent women. The woman I'm speaking about certainly was not. I want to give you an idea, a little background, though, into what is happening at this time. She is, to a certain degree, promoting a temperance rhetoric. And it goes back almost 100 years, and one of the best examples goes back to a man by the name of Lyman Beecher. And I want you to read you just briefly from a third of six sermons called The Evil of Intemperance, where he talks about how drunkenness leads to effeminacy. I'm just going to give you a couple of quotes from this, just to give you an idea of what is happening. The free and universal use of intoxicating liquors for a few centuries cannot fail to bring down our race from the majestic, athletic forms of our fathers to the similitude of a despicable and puny race of men. And he goes on to say that The injurious influence of general intemperance upon national intellect is equally certain and not less to be deprecated. Like heavy ordnance, the mind in its efforts recoils on the body and will soon shake down a puny frame. The mind itself becomes discouraged and falls into despondency and imbecility. Caesar, when he had a fever once and cried, "Give me some drink, Titinius," was not that God who afterwards overturned the Republic and reigned without a rival? And Bonaparte, it has been said, lost the Russian campaign by a fever, meaning drinking. The greatest poets and orators who stand on the records of immorality flourished in the Iron Age before the habits of effeminacy had unharnessed the body and unstrung the mind. Goes on to say that if the writers of Scotland had done this, we'd have never had great works. The taper fingers of modern effeminacy never wielded such a pen as these men yield and never will. He goes on and on and on, and drinking is associated with effeminacy. I think Mother Jones is very much tapping into this type of tradition when she talks about the men. Interesting thing about Mother Jones, as I go through the rest of this discussion, I'm going to point out several paradoxes. This is an extremely interesting woman for what she's doing. First of all, being a speaker in a man's world where men are really the only speakers at the time. But there's a paradox in how Mother Jones works. She uses what is, I would refer to classically as an a fortiori argument, an argument by degree. It's the type of argument that says, if you can't ski well down a green run, it's going to be really hard to ski down a blue run, and there's no way in heck you're going to ski down a black run. That's an argument by degree. And essentially, what Mother Jones is doing, though she doesn't state it, let's just show a picture of Mother Jones here. If I, Mother Jones, can stand up like a man to the owners and authorities of the mines, then you, the miners, who are men and more manly than me, should be able to stand up to the owners and authorities even more. And so she's very good at shaming them into being real men, because she seems to be more man than they are. But the paradox is, in this unstated argument, that Mother Jones' success depends in very great part on her identity as a woman, and especially as a frail old mother or grandmother. So in her September 16, 1913 speech at a convention of District 15 of the United Mine Workers of America in Trinidad, Mother Jones recounted an incident during her labor fights in West Virginia. "The strike came and I had to go with them. On the way I met an armed gang of guards with the miners. I walked over to one who was the captain of these bloodhounds and put my hand on the muzzle of that gun and stood there and addressed the miners with my hand on the gun. Never in all my history did I see anything like it. That fellow thirsted for man's blood. He actually thirsted to see the blood of those miners. Don't you dare let a bullet out of that," I said. "I don't have trouble where I am. I don't stand for it." The gang got afraid. Wow, that's pretty manly. But you know what? The question is, what would have happened if a man had grabbed the muzzle of that gun? It would have entirely been different. Mother Jones's manliness was only possible because her opponents would not treat her like they would treat a man. In other words, this is the old, if a girl hits you, you can't hit her back dilemma. Now, Mother Jones is also rather critical of the feminine. Just show you another picture of her here. The idea, again, is if an 80-year-old woman can be masculine, then how much more masculine can a real man be? What most undermined the natural order society was first, and I find this in her speeches, she thought that the natural order was being undermined first by the more feminine owners and operators of the mine and industry, more foppish, more rich, not willing to get their hands dirty. And second, the less than masculine response of the laborers in general. She was actually referring to the more feminine owners. It's my terminology here. But in her April 30th, 1914 speech, which was delivered soon after the deaths at Ludlow, she was introduced to the members of the convention of District 14, United Mine Workers of America in Pittsburgh, Kansas. and a delegate called for the men to put away their pipes in their pockets as a courtesy to her. Mother Jones' response was, "Huh, you should join John D. Rockefeller. You are getting so nice." And so she didn't like nicety. It wasn't masculine. Now, she also went after the less than masculine laborers who were the men. In one of her speeches, the same speech on April 30th, she says, "We are moral cowards. The whole of us are." And she found a link between drink and effeminate weakness in men. And when she goes after labor leaders who aren't doing their job, she often goes after them for drunkenness and weakness. She said in a speech on September 16th, 1913, "The whole civilized world centered her eyes on West Virginia. And why? Because we attended to business. We didn't allow any weaklings among us. If I saw a drunken organizer in the camp, I ordered him out immediately, and I will do the same here." Again, you're hearing some of the Lyman Beecher, drunkenness and effeminacy and weakness, physical weakness, as well as emotional and mental. She chides the miners. This is a picture of her, by the way, in a parade in Trinidad in 1913. She chides them. "How many of you laid down your tools and went down and told those bloodthirsty pirates, 'You stop murdering our men or we will take a hand in the game'? Not one." So she's chiding them. "They don't think that. They can go and play pool and go to the saloon and get a drink." So she often ties this lack of the workers' motivations and strength to handle a battle to drink and to effeminacy. The odd thing is, if you drink, you're also not allowing the feminine creature to be feminine because you aren't masculine enough as a miner. She criticizes them. She said in one case on April 30th, 1914, "Your district is insulted because your district president took a drunk bum off the force. If he had not taken him off, I would have gotten the police and arrested him because I ain't gonna stand for it. How many of you fellows, when you pay your assessments, when you pay your dues, how many of your fellows after years have got enough money to buy your wife a dress? How many of you have?" The idea being, if you're not responsible and you're drinking and you're spending money, you're not spending money on getting your wife a dress and letting her do her proper thing and being feminine. So by not being properly masculine, you're hurting her ability to be feminine. Let me go on here and talk a little bit more now about another interesting paradox, and that is the idea of turning for women to help. There's actually a case in this April 30th, 1914 speech where she complains about one of the leaders and gives him what for. Boy, does she howdy. "When I walked in, that brute, drawing his salary as an officer of the union organization, lay there on an old, dirty, filthy mattress. The mattress is on the floor, and he had a bottle of whiskey that long beside him. It was nothing to laugh at. This is a serious thing, and our organization was up against it at the time. We had to watch every angle, and I went in and said, 'What is the matter?' 'Oh, mother,' he said. Said her, 'The Baldwin guards are after me.' I said, 'That is too bad.' 'But,' I said, 'What are they after you for?' And he said, 'Because I've been too good to the miners.' And I said, 'You had better resign.'" This is the telling bit. "And he said, 'If you will tell me to, I will do it.'" Goes on to say, he said, "Am I president no more?' And I said, 'No, and you will never hold an office again while I am on earth. I mention these things because I plead with you that we are up against it. If you don't use your brains and your manhood, you will not save the labor movement of this country." Here's the paradox. She's upset that this man is drunk, weak enough that he is turning to her to ask permission, waiting to do what she guides him to do, and she clearly has a sense of disgust at this, and yet Mother Jones is someone who comes to the aid of miners when they turn to her for guidance. The difference seems to be that it seems okay to turn to her for guidance as long as the leaders are not weak or drunk. Now, she also goes after women. And this is another interesting sort of paradox that develops in her writings. She's frustrated, and she shares a story in this April 30th speech of women in Chicago who don't stand up to their employers. And she's frustrated that they're incapable of fighting for labor issues. And she says, when I looked or picked up the paper and saw that these sentimental women in Chicago were going to Marshall Fields and to others of the leading classes asking for an increase in wages and telling how much the maximum wage ought to be and how much they could live on, and these women never thought of making Marshall Field produce their books to see their profit they made of the life and blood of these girls. They didn't think that far. They don't belong to the class who is crucified. They belong to the sentimental class. And they must not hurt the feelings of the blood-sucking pirates. She's clearly upset that the women in their feminine state can't aggressively go after the labor leaders. She goes on to talk about how women need to fight like men, oddly enough, because their femininity is in jeopardy. If you could see the letters I get from the girls in different factories, oh God, Mother, we were afraid they would kill you. Mother, we want you. They're robbing us. They have destroyed our womanhood. Mother Jones was also especially critical of poor wages, which first forced girls into prostitution. A young girl passed me. She didn't seem very well clad. It was late, and I wondered what emergency it was that put that girl on the street at that hour of the night. And just as she passed me by, a man came the other way. She threw her arms around the man, and she said, "Take me for a dollar, mister. Don't blame me. I work over here in a department store. I get $2.75 a week. My father is dead, and my mother is sick. I have two little brothers and a sister. I send $1.50 to my mother. I pay 75 cents for my room, and I have 50 cents to spend and clothe myself," she said. And out of the blood and womanhood of that girl and thousands like her, we built the machinery that builds the great palaces of the invisible government, and we say it is right. And so industry, controlled by its wealthy owners, undermines traditional womanhood. But Mother Jones recognized that that very womanhood prevented women laborers from fighting the good fight. And so in part, she put the onus to handle this on the men, realizing it was their duty. "It is up to you, my boys, whether you go down in defeat or rise in this great nation like men ought to rise. It was time to do something when women and children were beaten by guards. The man will not protect himself against a Baldwin Felt's guard has no right on the soil of America. That we have a right to protect our women and children." Now, she did find one good man on the other side, the opposition. It was the man who was in charge of her while she was incarcerated in Walsenburg during the strike. "When they took me off the train that morning and put me down in that cold place, the colonel, Edward Verdickberg, who had charge there, said, 'Mother, this is the most repulsive position I've been placed in my life. Won't you go back to Denver?' 'This cellar,' said he, 'is not fit for a human being to be put in.' I said, 'Colonel, I appreciate your manhood and feelings fully, but it is a question of constitutional rights with me.' And so she stayed there. There was an appeal to masculine equality which ran through this. Let's go ahead here. This is actually her marching in December of 1913 with 500 miners with her to the steps of the Capitol to protest what was going on in Ludlow. We'll go back to stay on that one for now. So she made appeals for masculine equality. Think about it this way. If you think about women have got more equality today, it's often a masculizing of a feminine. It's not a feminizing of the masculine. Women are wearing pants. Men aren't wearing skirts. So there's a masculizing quality to equality in our nation's history, and she seems to call for it. "Every woman should arise in her right and stand shoulder to shoulder as the women of the old Romans did 2,000 years ago when they marched barefoot through the desert to carry the message of hope to their sister women and their brothers. That is the type of woman that has seen the jail and the scaffold and has stood side by side with her brother working on the battlefields, urging him to keep up this desperate struggle until our victory is ours." She goes on to say in this April 30 speech that I've quoted before, "The brave women of the northern Colorado fields came to me Sunday. 'Mother, they have four machine guns, but if you will go down, we don't care for their bullets.' I will be down, said I. And they can use their machine guns, they can slaughter us, but we will give our lives that the workers of America shall furl the flag of freedom. We are not going to surrender for no man. This idea of going into battle actually does have a masculine quality to it, and it comes out of the temperance movement. This actually is a picture from 1874 from the Harper's Weekly. Women could buckle on the armor of battle if the cause was moral and upright. By the way, note the man. You just see his leg in the bottom right, fleeing. Note the man who is fleeing like a coward from the woman in the bottom right of the picture. This is not a masculine man who drinks and flees. He's a chicken. He's effeminate. And so, we have this wonderful woman, incredibly caring, who, when she was no longer a mother, because her family had passed away, she became a mother to everyone else. When asked in congressional hearings where her address was, where she lived, because that's part of, you know, establishing a record, you are Mother Jones, where do you live? She said, wherever the call is needed. She had no identifiable permanent residence that she gave to Congress. She helped women and children, and she was a mother. But at the same time she did this, she was the paradox. She was this defiant leader who made the argument, if I, a mere 80-year-old woman, can be masculine and stand up to them, how much more can you be if you are the men you are supposed to be? And so I am fascinated by this paradox we call Mother Jones.
Our last speaker for this session is Jonathan Rees, a professor of history at Colorado State University Pueblo. He teaches courses in American history, including labor history, Colorado history, and the history of technology. He received an MA and PhD in U.S. history from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is the author of many articles published in educational historical journals, as well as three books. One, Representation and Rebellion, the Rockefeller Plan at the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company, 1914 to 1942. Two, Managing the Mills, Labor Policy in American Steel Industry During the Non-Union Era. And a book to be released by Johns Hopkins University Press in mid-2013, Industrialization and the Transformation of American Life, A Brief Introduction, Refrigeration Nation, A History of Ice, Enterprise, and Appliances. Jonathan.
Thank you. Stephen, I just want to say that you're a better Mother Jones impersonator than several Mother Jones impersonators I've seen. Which I find quite remarkable. It could be a calling. You can ask me details about the Ludlow Massacre, and Stephen's presentation made me think that maybe that's probably the best place to start. No, I have it even better. Why don't I ask you, Kathy, you're not allowed to answer this question. What was the Ludlow Massacre? Anybody, quick version, two or three sentences. All right, am I going to have to do this in the beginning? Raise your hand. All right, you want to take it? Yeah. Women and children. Minors are killed too. It looks like maybe the best place for me to start, rather than the script or anything like that, is just a very brief outline of what Ludlow was. I'm actually on the state committee, the Centennial Committee. Next year is the beginning, this year is the centennial of the beginning of the strike that the Ludlow Massacre culminates with. And Governor Hickenlooper named me and a bunch of other people who are interested in Ludlow to sort of organize the 100th anniversary activities. So maybe my first 100th anniversary activity will be just make sure that everybody knows the players or at least the events without a scorecard. So the Ludlow Massacre of 1914, April 20th, if anyone's counting, is the culminating event in the Great Colorado Coalfield Strike of 1913-1914. So the miners who are looking for representation by the United Mine Workers of America go out on strike in September of 1913. In 1914, April 20th, they get involved in a firefight with the Colorado National Guard. And the strike ends in December 1914, because basically once the army gets called in, there's really no hope that the miners are ever going to win. After the event itself, the April 20th event, when a lot of women, and I'll talk about numbers in just a second, a lot of women and children are killed, the miners of Southern Colorado go on a rampage. And there is violence all over Southern Colorado, much more violence, many more casualties in the 9 or 10 days after the Ludlow Massacre than during the massacre itself. So the Ludlow Massacre is this sort of one-day event, and it's a very serious one, maybe the most bloody single event in the history of the American labor movement, but it's just part of this much longer story. And what I wanted to talk about is the historiography of the Ludlow Massacre, and you really have to understand that if you're going to make sense of the historiography. When we talk Ludlow Massacre, we tend to just hear about the women and children. We think of pictures like that. That's a John Sloan, by the way. The Mass is a leftist publication. I actually have a theory that the Ludlow Massacre is, in a worldly sense, the most important thing that ever happened in Colorado, simply because it attracted the most attention for the most years afterwards. And that's a good place to start this talk, because it gives you an idea how most people remember the Ludlow Massacre, which is a bloody massacre of miners and children and women. It is, but as the story gets told, more facts go into that interpretation and things look a little more complicated. Let's begin with the monument. That is the Ludlow Monument. It is about a mile away from the highway, exit 27 off of I-25. It is built by the United Mine Workers of America. Is dedicated in 1918. The employer of most of those miners was the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company. The primary stockholder of the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company was John D. Rockefeller Jr., not the oil baron, it's the oil baron's son. And by that time, the older Rockefeller had retired, he'll live another 20 plus years, but Rockefeller Jr. is taking care of all of the family's investments, and CF&I is just one of those investments. He actually shows up at the dedication, gets one of his aides, guy who ended up being Prime Minister of Canada, to ask if he can talk to all the people, the hundreds of miners who were involved in that strike, about his role in the massacre. And they say, no, we can't guarantee your safety. So he drives off and continues to tour the rest of Colorado. The reason he wanted to do that is because after the massacre happens, he is absolutely excoriated in the press, gets some of the worst press in the history of American businessmen. Upton Sinclair marches outside his home, puts on a mock trial outside his mansion in North Tarrytown, New York, as to his responsibility for this sort of thing. What Rockefeller did is he said, you guys who run CF&I, we have complete faith in you. You do what needs to be done. He didn't say go out and kill women and children. But what happens, now I wish I had a picture of the death pit, and I don't. But what happens, you can visit, if you visit that site, you can see the pit where women, actually, this is kind of apt. You can see the pit where most of those people died. That is the plaque on the back side of the monument. Just a couple words about the plaque, because I think it's really interesting. First, if you look at the last names of everybody, it's a perfect little microcosm of the population of Southern Colorado at the time, and to a certain extent, a good microcosm of the population of Southern Colorado to this day. Second of all, and what I always just want to start weeping, is you look at the ages. I mean, they put the ages of everybody who died there deliberately, because you're just thinking of one of those little babies living and dying entirely in that camp. What you should also know, and I've seen so many people mess this up, is that these women and children are not shot to death. They're suffocated. It's a tent colony where they're living during the strike. There's a firefight. All the best historians say nobody can tell who fired first, but we do know that the Colorado National Guard set fire to the camps. But the problem is most of those people, Louis Tikus is a whole other story accepted, most of those people who die, and a couple people actually survived this, go down in the pit under their tent in order to avoid the firefight. And when the tents are set on fire, they die of smoke inhalation. They're not shot. There is no deliberate attempt to kill women and children. I have heard professors say that Rockefeller killed the women and children, and I am not a big fan of John D. Rockefeller Jr., but he did not set out to do this. He didn't say, oh, let's go kill women and children. In a very sick, perverted way, though, the Ludlow Massacre becomes a gift to the United Mine Workers of America. In a Victorian era, remember my own quotes, speaking of Mother Jones, that's from her autobiography. In a Victorian era where women and children are supposed to be protected, the fact that the Colorado National Guard kills women and children turns the entire public perceptions of the strike upside down. And you've got organizations like the Rocky Mountain News, still an incredibly conservative paper in 1914. Actually, it's the Rocky Mountain News that coins the term Ludlow Massacre a few days after it happens. So you take this massacre, it is something that makes the union look like victims, but it creates sympathy for that cause, and which is why the Ludlow Massacre becomes a very important event in the history of the United Mine Workers and the history of labor in this country and other countries around the world. From about 1914, I could do a few other details from the immediate years afterwards where Rockefeller is testifying before Congress. But really, from about 1914 to the 1950s, the United Mine Workers of America has Ludlow all to itself. They're the ones who determine the history of this event. They can tell it the way they like. The common response to this is, pay no attention to these terrible atrocity over here. Look at the wonderful stuff that business is doing everywhere else in the country. They simply don't want to talk about it. The United Mine Workers of America Journal, who's beginning to tell the story of Ludlow the way they want it to be remembered. They lose the strike, right? But the idea of the UMWA is that it's sort of a moral victory because of the victims that this incident created. What I wanted to get to is that Baron Brochure's book, Out of the Depths. Oh, that's wrong. It's 42. Speaking of typos on PowerPoint presentations. Brochure was the son of the doctor who treated the people in the Ludlow tank colony. And he creates, there's not a single footnote in the entire book. He creates, my friend Scott Martell, we'll get to in a little bit, basically is convinced that Brochure just makes up dialogue out of whole cloth. And the miners are the victims, and Rockefeller is the villain, and the sides are real clear. The Golden Bell Press, which is where my edition comes from, is a union press. It is the standard union story and is the only, story that you're going to hear for a long time, even before it's written and after. You may know the Woody Guthrie song about the Ludlow Massacre. I could have, if I was really good, I would have been able to play you a snippet of it right now with some wonderful electronic gizmo. But if you're interested, you can find the lyrics just about anywhere by Googling it. Woody Guthrie takes the victimization narrative, gets all the details wrong, and now if you have heard of the Ludlow Massacre, the Guthrie song is just about the only thing that you've ever heard of. It shouldn't be that way. That is from a poem. I guess I'm doing this in slightly off chronological order. Frank Hayes is the president of the United Mine Workers at that ceremony dedicating the monument. He reads, it's a longer poem than this, and he reads that poem, and it helps set the union interpretation in amber. I mean, we know, it's not like they're going out and saying, Rockefeller, you murdered those people. They didn't know he was going to show up in the car when they're trying to do the ceremony, but they know who the villain is in their story. They're focusing on the victims, and everybody was from Upton Sinclair to the Rocky Mountain News was blaming Rockefeller for this. And so they want to set that story quite... Rockefeller ends up sort of ignoring it after a while. But for historiography's sake, the history of Ludlow, he's the heavy for a very long time. Weirdly enough, that begins to change with the work of a guy named George McGovern. George McGovern obviously just died a few months ago. We had a chance to host him in Pueblo back in 2004. He was a professional historian before he became a senator. I got a chance to talk to him about his career because we were interested not in what he did in the Senate. We were interested in his first work, his dissertation, which, you know, you can order dissertations if you're interested. It is a history of the 1913-14 strike. That dissertation was enough for him to get a job at Dakota Wesleyan. He told me that when he was doing research on this in the early 50s, that he would like go to the movies in Denver and they would show old newsreels of Mother Jones and the whole theater would stand up and boo. Right? So the Union had its story. Mother Jones's was famous for many other things, but most people had forgotten Ludlow. His advisor was a Princeton historian named Arthur Link. And Arthur Link was really the world's foremost Woodrow Wilson scholar. And the reason McGovern did this is that Link said, hey, there's this big incident in Colorado, then it's in the Wilson administration, and no one's ever done it. You should do it. So he did it. Hopefully the quote suggests, I was just looking for a good quote to give you a flavor of the piece, that it's kind of a sympathetic the miners, that McGovern was a liberal even before he was a politician. He is pro-labor. I mean, it's not the work of of the caricature of George McGovern that you might remember from the 72 election. It is a standard, slightly left of center, historical stuff. And it's good. I actually think his dissertation is better than this, which is the follow-up book. What happens is that when he is preparing to run for president, Houghton Mifflin says, hey, we'd like to republish your dissertation. And McGovern, being not stupid, realizes that if you just throw a dissertation out and you give it to a major press, it's not going to work. So he hires a guy named Leonard Gutridge to do some extra research, which is why I can't quite see it there, but the Great Coalfield War is McGovern and Gutridge. I don't have the title of the dissertation. I guess I could dig it out of the paper. But I can tell you the dissertation is just about 1314. The Great Coalfield War starts around 1906. And I think this is the great pivot in the history of Ludlow historiography, all in the body of George McGovern's work. Because when he's looking at just the strike, it's not a completely pro-union work, but it's focused very clearly on the awful things that people did to the United Mine Workers of America. When you broaden the picture, when you stretch it out to 1906 through 1914, when you start talking about a series of wars and you go to other places beyond Ludlow, the relationship between labor and management, who to side for, who's got the white hats on, who's got the black hats on, it's not quite as clear. So when you look at, that quote from the Great Coalfield War, in which he's talking about Rockefeller's testimony before Congress, you can see much more sympathy for John D. Rockefeller Jr. than you do in the earlier work. He's realizing that you might believe what he believes for heartfelt reasons, and some of this might be politics, some of it might be because you don't want to look like you're pro-union when you're about to run for president, some of this might be just the added perspective, some of it might be Gutridge. I forgot to ask him where Gutridge came from, but Gutridge is doing most of the extra research, so we know that he's responsible for most of the stuff that doesn't appear in the dissertation. But it's just funny, if you ever get a chance to look at both of them back to back, they're almost like night and day different. McGovern is, besides being famous, literally the first professional historian to touch this subject. Oops, I gotta go back. The second professional historian to touch the subject with a book entirely devoted to this is Scott Martell. was actually not a professional historian either. He was a journalist for the Los Angeles Times, and now he's a professional author. Blood Passion comes out in 2007. I went to see Scott when he showed up in Barnes & Noble in Pueblo at one point, got to know him really well. I can tell you that Martel is just about the biggest leftist you will ever find. It is impossible to tell that from the book. He approaches the subject as a reporter. He'll tell you the good things for the labor side. He'll tell you the bad things about the labor side. And this, I think, is probably the most telling part of the entire book, where most of the book is simple reporting. Here's what happened in the strike from beginning to end. But he's basically telling you it's not really a massacre. It's just a lot of terrible miscommunication. Now, I just find it interesting that the more the historians examine the subject, the less sympathetic it appears to labor. And these are not people who are out writing books in order to destroy labor. They are writing books for added perspective. And as the historiography of Ludlow expands and the perspective increases, labor's story gets, original story at least, gets lost in the mix. My friend Thomas Andrews, who I actually went to graduate school with, I knew Thomas Andrews before he was famous. He won the Bancroft Prize for this book in Ludlow. He now teaches at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He's actually an environmental historian by training. He decided to write about Ludlow. And I will tell you this. I assign Martel's book to undergraduates and this book to grad students. But they go together really well. Andrews literally goes back to the dawn of creation and talking about, you know, where coal comes from in order to tell the story of Ludlow. So you're getting a much different, much broader perspective. And what he says is when you take just one event and you take it out of the stream of time, it's going to distort what's going on. And he's not anti-labor, he's interested in other things. And the historians are the ones who change the picture of the Ludlow Massacre because they're interested in things beyond the labor dispute. And lastly, this is my last slide, a little bit of yesterday and today. I'm actually not anti-labor either. I'm a trade unionist. I'm a labor historian. I'm a historian of technology. I'm very sympathetic to the miners when I look at Ludlow. But nevertheless, I think that it's possible that we should take different parts of the Ludlow story, like the 9-Day War, and use that as examples of labor action, people who are asserting their agency rather than being passive victims. And if you look, say, back at the United Mine Workers Journal from 1918, when the statue was dedicated, you can see streams of that non-victimization, that more pro-agency position in what they were saying at the time the monument was dedicated. And if you go to the Ludlow Memorial, the annual memorial that they do every year, as I do whenever I'm in town, you can see UMW President Cecil Roberts has begun to adopt the same sort of strategy. It's not just about remembering the dead. It's remembering the dead for the purpose of a call to action. So we historians who are giving all this extra perspective are not necessarily contradicting labor. Hopefully, we're giving them really a guide in which they can take the memories of Ludlow and have a better future as a result. Thank you very much.
Despite what your stomach might say, we're going to take time for a few questions. Questions for these speakers. Yes, sir.
I got one for the Ludlow guy that just came in. Didn't they debase that statue here a while back?
Yeah.
Let me repeat it for our audience.
Yeah,
was the Ludlow statue defaced, the monument?
Yes, it was. We don't know who they is, but that was 2003, I think. I believe that Cecil Roberts quote comes from the rededication ceremony after they put the head back on. If you go to the statue and you can look at it very, very closely, you can tell where the new marble is. But really, they did a fantastic job. You have to look very closely to see where it happened.
Yes, sir.
Yes, Dr. Collins. Wasn't the labor leader, Tikas, treacherously murdered on the morning of that fire? I mean, wasn't Tikas murdered?
The question is, was George Tikas murdered on the day of the fire?
Yeah, because he's a martyr, he's on the monument, but he wasn't in the death pit. The story is, and there's every reason to believe it's true, that he and a couple of other people came under a white flag in order to negotiate the peace, and he was killed by the Colorado National Guard in cold blood while he was still under the white flag.
Yes, sir.
Question for Stephen Collins. Do you know if Mother Jones had any family history of alcoholism or
What he's saying is, was Mother Jones a lush? Stephen?
Stephen, where? Do you want to move
younger
over?
Family. Okay. Was there any incidence of alcoholism in the Jones family?
I don't think that's necessarily the case. With a lot of the temperance advocates during the 19th century, the reason why they were driven to not have anyone drink liquor was because it protected the women and the children. And quite often there was in fact, there are wonderful sketches at the time that talk about the progression of intemperance that show what happens, and eventually the men are spending all the money on drink, and so there's no money for the women and the children to support them. They're often driven out, they lose their homes, etc. And quite often in the worst cases they're beaten. And so a lot of women are going in for this with the Women's Christian Temperance Union and very much supporting temperance in order to protect women and children. And quite often I think you don't have to have this type of background in order to see this. I'd say the majority of the women in the 19th century supported this position.
One more question? Yes, in the back there, sir.
Question about Sand Creek. Did Colonel Shivington ever face any civil prosecution or penalties or repercussions from his actions there?
Chris, maybe you could take that, or Kathy, or both?
Yeah, we can share it. There were actually three investigations, Army, House Committee, Senate Committee, and there was sort of pressure on him in order to resign any military commission, or he could have had more of a real court-martial. He certainly lost reputation. There are all sorts of negative impacts on him, but not exactly a civil prosecution. Did you want to answer more, Chris?
Just to add two more pieces to that. He does run for a public office later in life back in Ohio, and his opponent threatens to bring Sand Creek up, and he's forced to drop out. So it's not a formal thing, but it does impact his later success. And there was actually a hall named after him. He was a Masonic lodge up in Central City as great victor of Sand Creek. And then later in life, again, family history, so fascinating. His son passes away, and he marries his son's widow to facilitate some freighting businesses. And as a result of that, his name's taken off the Masonic Lodge. So he doesn't suffer any official censure, but it certainly harms his prestige and importance later in life.
And I should apologize. I forgot to repeat that question. The question was Colonel Shivington ever prosecuted? I repeat those for our audience out there, including my brother in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hello, Greg. Okay.